Hi, my name is Anne McElhinney.
And I'm Philip McAleer.
And welcome to the Anne Film Scoop. It is week 49 of the two-week Flatten the Curve lockdown, which means that in 2 weeks' time, it'll be a year.
When we had it just 2 weeks and we'll flatten the curve and then all the restrictions will be over.
Something else happened a year ago, Philip. What happened a year ago?
Oh, a year ago.
Where were we a year ago? Let's look at a photograph of where we were a year ago. Look
I recognise that fella.
I recognise how very attractive I look, I think, in that photograph. Yes.
A year ago. As somebody in the White House said, the last fun day in the White House. They called it, the last fun day in the
world. I like that. But we're going to look, talking of the pandemic and COVID and all of that, we're going to look at a story of COVID hypocrisy, which just, the hypocrisy never, never ends. And yes. The story is it brings us all the way to Berkeley.
Yes, a COVID nightmare for you, but not for me. Typical liberal Berkeley fashion.
Exactly. And we have our favourite, later in the show, we have an interview with our favourite Washington insider.
Yes, and that might sound like a contradiction in terms, but there are some great people working away against the deep state and who are in the Trump administration fighting the deep state blobs. We talk to our good friend Mark Paoletta later. And we look at how young women are finding that their grandmothers and everyone else's advice was right after all, but they think they've just discovered the joy of young people finding the truth.
And we look at the real reason why the Democratic establishment is now turning on Andrew Cuomo. And let's make it really clear that this has not anything to do with the care of, about how they care about women.
Women, yeah, you know, and yeah. And what's the recipe, Anne?
And we have a great recipe, which it kind of is, it is a recipe, by the way. It is it's kind of recipe, non-recipe. It's the simplest ever dinner recipe or lunch recipe or impress people recipe that makes you look impressive, but is actually so, so simple and really, really yummy. And one of as they say in the cookery programs, in very heavy rotation around here. Is that right, Phil?
Yes.
Very heavy rotation.
Indeed.
Which will allow us as well, by the way, to talk maybe later on if we have time about the madness at Bon Appetit magazine and what they're doing as a result of the wokeism.
They're certainly rotating their recipes.
And we're going to finish the show with a really lovely story that I thought was quite inspiring this last period. But we're going to start by looking at what happened in Berkeley.
Yes.
And this is an extraordinary story. Look at the video that we're just showing right now. This is Matt Meyer. Take a look at this guy here. This guy is the Berkeley Unified Union president. And look at him there, the white fellow.
Berkeley Unified is the school district.
Berkeley Unified. And look at him with the lovely dregs that he's got there.
I think you call them dreads. Dregs are things you find in the bottom of your coffee mug.
Which, by the way, you know, right. And wait till you hear the end of the story and I might be using the word correctly. Mm. Matt Meyer, who has led efforts keeping Berkeley schools closed for nearly a year because it's unsafe, got caught dropping his daughter off at a private in-person school. So why is it safe for him but not for the rest of us?
This is from
Reopen California.
Yeah, but the people who posted it are a group called Guerrilla Moms.
Yes.
Which is a great name.
A group known as Guerrilla Moms is calling Berkeley Federation Teachers President Matt Meyer a hypocrite.
I think they're
fairly accurate there. Yes. After spotting him dropping his two-year-old daughter off at an in-person instruction in a private preschool. And to hell with the rest of the people, you know.
Let's be quite clear. He's campaigning for schools, for parents not, he says it's unsafe for teachers to have children in schools, but he is dropping his kid off, and if it's not in a preschool where there's teachers, so is it not safe? Is it safe for those kids and those children and those teachers? He's a hypocrite. He's an absolute hypocrite.
Yeah, this is an awful person. By the way, he has refused all efforts from every quarter to give an interview and to explain himself. But he did write to, I think, Fox News. He told Fox News in a statement that he thought that the video was very, very unfair. Even though the video blurred out the identity of his daughter, he said it was an intrusion into his child's privacy. Yeah, well, he's intruding, by the way, into the mental and physical health of thousands and thousands of children. So, you know, I think it's fair game, actually.
Yes.
And the child's identity has not been revealed.
It's been blurred out.
And has been blurred out. And he needs to, I mean, really horrible. Another awful example, you know, of this kind of horrible hypocrisy that we've had to deal with.
So now we're going over to our interview, Mark Paoletta. We recorded it just before we came on air. Let's go over and talk and introduce to you to the wonderful Mark Paoletta.
Welcome, Mark Paoletta. How to describe Mark? First of all,
First of all, he's a friend.
Yes. I suppose back at the beginning, he graduated from Georgetown Law, I believe. He served as a lawyer in Bush 41 at the White House. And most recently was a general counsel at the Office of Management and Budget, which in the Trump administration, which the OMB, which is a probably not very particularly well-known part of the administrative branch, but probably one of the most powerful. He worked on the confirmation hearings of Gorsuch and Kavanaugh recently. The Washington Post, which quite funny, the Washington Post did a profile of him recently and described him as a hard-charging conservative lawyer, little known to the public, who's responsible for executing some of the White House's most divisive and legally aggressive moves. Certainly one of his greatest achievements was pushing the Clarence Thomas confirmation hearing, the early Kavanaugh hearing, people where Thomas was accused of not very much, actually, but it became a massive story, and Mark pushed and is very, very responsible for Clarence Thomas winning that nomination. He is now a senior fellow at the Center for American Restoration, which is a new group set up by Russ Vought, who is the former director of the OMB under President Trump. And as I said, he's a friend of ours, and he's even had a starring role in one of our productions.
Oh, that's right.
We'll
get to. For right now, welcome to the podcast, Mark. It's lovely to have you here.
And Phelan, thank you for having me on. It's your dear friends, and I love all the things you do. And so thanks for having me on.
The main, apart from the fact that we like talking to you, the main reason we have you on here today is that you recently wrote an article in Breitbart. And I remember before you wrote the article, it's about how Amazon Prime have stopped streaming a documentary about Clarence Thomas in his own words, basically, in Black History Month. And I remember before you disappeared, you talked about we had a conversation, where would be the best place for it? And we discussed the various options. And I remember saying to you, one thing about Breitbart is it has enormous reach. There are articles on there that get 10,000, 5,000, 10,000, sometimes even 12 or 15,000 comments. I'm just looking. It currently has 23,000 comments.
And by the way, the other thing I noticed is once Mark's piece came out about this travesty, by the way, of suddenly deplatforming Clarence Thomas's documentary or putting it, and forgetting that he's actually an African-American hero. Everyone else started writing about it. Everyone followed after that. Yes, the whole world were writing about it then.
Yeah. So tell us about your relationship with Clarence Thomas. Tell us about how you worked on the nomination. But then tell us about this documentary. We know the filmmakers. We've talked about it many times on this show. It's called Created Equal, Clarence Thomas, in his own words. I'd recommend it to anyone. It's educational, it's entertaining, it's wonderful, and that's probably why it's been banned. But go ahead, tell us about you and Clarence Thomas and this documentary.
Sure. So the documentary is called Created Equal, Clarence Thomas in His Own Words. It was shown on PBS, National Broadcast. Theatrically released in January, actually, just before COVID hit.
That's right.
I went to the movie theater in Georgetown, sold out. It did phenomenally well. And then it went on PBS, and then it started streaming on various platforms, including Amazon, several months ago. And I actually purchased it on Amazon, and I got a lot of the DVDs too, but I went to send it to a friend actually on February 8th. So this is just me, just sort of, I've been pushing this movie and people, friends ask about it. So I went to email it to a friend and I couldn't find it on the Amazon site. And I was like, what's going on here? So I reached out to the director, who's a great friend, Michael Pack, director, producer. And I asked him, what do you think is going on here? Can you check into it? He went to his the production company, the distributor, Blue Fox, and they got back to him and said, they don't know what's going on. And they never got an answer from February 8th until I wrote the piece. And today I just checked before I came on, it's still not up. And it went down on February 8th, funny enough. So some point on February 8th, right before I was looking for it, it was taken down. And some friends have reached out to me saying, you think this is a licensing issue? It's 100% not a licensing issue. We checked with Blue Fox. They don't have to put any deadlines on their licenses for the films that they distribute. Amazon reserves the right in the agreement to take it down. And in fact, that's what they did. And they did it during Black History Month. And I was so ripped, right? That here's this incredible documentary, and I'll get to that in a second, that was taken down during Black History Month. And when you go to the Amazon site, the Prime site, and you look at all the movies, they have an entire section for to celebrate Black History Month.
That's great.
But you know, they have to have space for the longest, the only right now serving Black justice on the United States Supreme Court, the longest serving. And when you read about Clarence Thomas, and I put this out in my story, you know, he is, as one liberal writer has written, the most important legal thinker in the past generation and the most significant appointment to the Supreme Court in 40 years. Okay. Mm-hmm. So Clarence Thomas is a force, is a phenomenon on the Supreme Court, right? And that's just his kind of legal scholarship, right? What makes Clarence Thomas incredible, right, is his American story, right? And that's what this movie captures, which is born in the segregated South in 1948 in Pinpoint, Georgia, right? Deep South, right? Mother and father, uneducated. Father leaves at 2 years, when Clarence is 2 years old. His mom finds it difficult to raise two kids because she's working a bunch of jobs, and he goes to work, live with his grandfather, with his brother, his younger brother. And that changes his life when he's 7 years old. And it's just this incredible journey, an American journey of Clarence Thomas overcoming these obstacles. You know, his path, right, to getting appointed, which includes rejecting all the values that his grandfather taught him in the Catholic Church, where he went to school, in a segregated Catholic school down there, taught by Irish nuns, embraces, right, the Black Panthers and sort of the hard left during college, and then goes to a protest that turns into a riot in Boston in the 60s. He's in the heart of all that, and he looks hard into it and he rejects it, right? And the kind of his embrace of this is individual freedom, right? The Declaration of Independence, all men are created equal. In fact, that's what the documentary is called, is Created Equal. And so it's a beautiful story that's caught on this in this movie. And the thing about the movie is Michael Pack, who's the director, and good friend of you guys, he was able to convince Clarence Thomas to sit down for 24 hours of interviews. 24 hours of interviews. So it's like a one-on-one that goes through his whole life with all the questions asked that anyone would want to ask Clarence Thomas, about his life and about his jurisprudence. It's just this beautiful movie. And the fact that Amazon, worked on it, the fact that they took it down was completely outrageous. And again, I looked at different movies that are up there still, right? On Thurgood Marshall, right? Yeah. On RBG, all these movies, right, that were not doing as well as Clarence Thomas, and they're all up there, right? Several of them, right? There's like four.
By the way, I'm glad. Yeah, actually, just stop on that point, because you brought that up in your article.
Yeah.
I mean, tell us about the success of the film, because you actually have some really good metrics that you can share with us.
So one of the things that happened when I went on the site just before I submitted the article to Breitbart, I checked, it was 38th of all documentaries on the Amazon website in the DVD section. Right?
In the DVD
section.
Down on the Prime. Yeah.
In the DVD section, it was 38. RBG was 103. You know, every other movie, you know, and any justice stories, I'm like, it was in the hundreds, if not thousands. There's a lot of movies. When you see some of these numbers, it's crazy. 547,000 ranked. It was 38th. When I wrote this piece, and again, you're getting to the Breitbart reaction impact. It went to, listen to this now, number 16 of all movies on the Amazon website. This is talking about like Hollywood blockbusters, all that sort of stuff. It went to number 16.
Of all movies
on Amazon. I took a picture of the site in case anyone ever doubted me, right? But number 16, number one in documentaries. They sold out of the documentary.
I was just trying to look. That's why I was sort of.
Yeah, so that's gone. It's gone back down. I looked at the numbers just before. It was 29-12, I think, of all movies today. I looked at number 21 in documentaries. Uh-huh. But again, I think if you go on the Amazon website, I think there's probably another 150 comments. So go by most recent, and you'll see everyone ripped about it being taken down, right? Good. And going someplace else to watch it. If people want to watch the movie or get the movie, go to justicethomasmovie.com. That's the Michael Pack production company. You know, they set this website up. It's got great stuff on the film itself, but it also has all the places where it's available for links and where you can buy the DVD of it.
Of course, Anita Hill, they have a
they've told her story in six different ways, you know, documentary, film, made for TV movie, animation, anime. I'm joking about that.
She's there, but they took down Clarence Thomas's documentary during Black History Month.
Here's the other thing. I actually had I don't know if I have it here. I had, but for a while I was Googling, because this obviously became a little focus of me, but I was Googling on my phone. I was on my iPhone.
We've met
Clarence Thomas, created equal. If you punched in the search terms, created equal and Clarence Thomas, in, at least on the Amazon site, right? You would think, right, given the name of the movie and the fact that it's about Clarence Thomas, it would be the first thing that came back, right? As of yesterday, now it changed a little bit today, but the stuff that came up was the 23rd entry on the second page, and you had three Anita Hill movies that were listed before it. How these movies, all the what I'll call the critical doc books on Clarence Thomas came up before that, right? Justice, Supreme Discomfort, all these terrible books. And those all seem to somehow come up before Created Equal came up. So you have the streaming issue, right? Which is a problem, right? That they took it down. But also in terms of selling the DVD, they seem to be burying it, right?
Yes.
And
yes.
What I love is that, you know, the readers of Breitbart and then all these other publications and Fox did a segment on it. They reached out, but the fact that people went to the site and found it, right? No matter how hard it was and purchased it.
So Amazon have not responded yet. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's what I wanted to know.
Yeah, that's my understanding is Blue Fox reached out to them several times and they hadn't responded. I know that Fox News or, you know, Fox and Friends yesterday or on Saturday morning had said that they reached out to Fox, to Amazon and they had not responded. I said, some people raised that it might have been a licensing issue. It's not a licensing issue.
No. I wondered
somebody
about
raised,
that.
Yeah. As you saw from the, I think I referenced it in the Breitbart piece, and somebody had raised it to me before as like one of the maybe it's that Amazon was taking down a lot of documentaries across the board, and some of them may have been liberal. And I, as you see in my article, I'm like, I don't care if there's a lot of ones that are being taken down and some of them are liberal films. This is a documentary that's critically acclaimed, that was shown on PBS, right? Incredible reviews. Right? If you look at all these other movies on the various folks involved at the Clarence Thomas, they have very few reviews, right? Clarence Thomas movies is at 4.9 stars out of 5. If you go to the Rotten Tomatoes site, it's a 90% audience score. Of course, the critic score is 33 or something like that.
Course,
but again, you had the Pulitzer Prize winning writer Kathleen Parker at the Washington Post say it was a masterpiece, and that Clarence Thomas is an American hero after watching that. And there was not a dry eye in the theater when she saw the movie when it was in the theatrical release. Now, going back to, I was lucky enough and fortunate enough to work in the White House in Bush 41, and I won't take too much time here, but I actually met Clarence Thomas in 1983 when I was a senior in college, met him up in Bridgeport, Connecticut, of all places, my hometown. Spent a couple hours with him at an event that I met him at. And because of that, when I was in the White House a few years later, I volunteered to reach out to him when we were considering him for the DC circuit. And I reached out to him and asked him to send me all of his writings and materials. And I read them. This is at the time he's the EEOC chairman.
Mm-hmm.
And he sent me everything. We had a great talk. And, you know, anyone who meets Clarence Thomas immediately loves him, right? So you can imagine I was 26 years old. I reached out to Clarence Thomas and we ended up talking for an hour and a half. And, you know, you immediately love him, right? And he sent me all his material. And you could see him throwing thunderbolts back then, right? Just taking it to Congress, taking it to the civil rights establishment, taking it to everybody, right? Calling out the hypocrisy. And I loved it. I was so excited reading it. But then I'm thinking, wow, we're going to have to get this guy confirmed, right? And at that time, there was like, I think it was 56 or 57 Democrats. Right? The Democrats controlled Congress for 40 years at that point, right?
And so there was a filibuster then too, wasn't it? You needed
actually, you know what? You know what, Phelan? Things have changed. So on Supreme Court nominations, you didn't do filibusters in terms of nominations like Bork and all stuff. So we had 57. We just needed to win a majority. Clarence Thomas got through on the D.C. circuit. When he came around for the Supreme Court, I was still there at the White House and became his sort of right-hand person during the confirmation. And worked with him, you know, round the clock, and it was a horrible, horrible experience. But what I learned from that, right, is that, you know, when you stand up for something and you stand against the grain, people are going to attack you, right? Mm-hmm. And they can even make things up, because I believe the Anita Hill story is completely fabricated, okay? And I saw the toll it took on him and how awful it was to go through it, you know, go through it. And it was terrible for me. It was awful, awful, awful for him and his wife, Ginny. Mm. But out of that terrible, terrible time, you know, was born this friendship. Mm. And just to show you the kind of person Clarence Thomas is, about 6 months after he was confirmed, I was diagnosed with cancer and had to go through chemo and all that. And Clarence Thomas came over to my house every day, called me every day. He's a Supreme Court justice. He's going through his own sort of healing, right? And he came by, brought me hamburgers, brought me pecan pie, just hung out with me, took me out to his new house that they were building, and just was a wonderful, wonderful friend. So we've been friends ever since. I set up a website called justicethomas.com, which is another website which has a lot of his writings and opinions and articles about him. I direct your viewers to that website, but I've watched him on the court, obviously, and he is, you know, and from day one, as I point out in my article, there's not a lot of hyperlinks in that piece. I wrote it pretty fast because I was pretty ripped, and so a lot of times I put hyperlinks in. But Jan Crawford wrote a great book. She's a CBS Supreme Court reporter. It's about the Roberts Court, but she got the documents from Harry Blackmun's internal documents when he passed away, and shows that Clarence Thomas from day one was moving the court in his direction, right? On the very first vote, it was, I think, 7-1, 8-1. And by the end of it, it was 5-4. Thomas had moved. It was still a minority, but he had moved, brought all these justices to him in his argument.
Well, I mean, there's a meme going around now, and maybe you couldn't possibly comment, but the meme where it's Justice Thomas looking at Justice Roberts saying, look at me, I'm the captain now. Yeah, so, I mean, it may be, you know, they may talk about the Thomas Court in, you know, maybe they are now, but we're looking at, and it's not just the Thomas Court, but he's bringing lots of people, like, you know, lots of people don't know how bad socialism is until somebody sits down and tells them, you know, and when you've got someone like Justice Thomas telling people and telling young lawyers this is wrong and here's why it's wrong, and, you know, and having as a voice there, he's influencing a whole generation, many generations of lawyers and legal thinkers. And as
you know, Phelan, I completely agree. And every justice gets 4 law clerks every year, right? So Clarence Thomas has been on the court for 30 years, right? That's 120 lawyers. When you look at what they've done, I think there's 20 of them that are on the federal courts now, and several on the circuit courts, which are the second, you know, so there's, and 2 of Thomas' clerks are on the D.C. circuit, which many regard as kind of the second most important court in the land. And that he's going to leave lots of legacies. One of them is going to be that he's created this group of lawyers, right, or helped influence them, who are going to go out and actually try and change the world, I think, following in his footsteps. And that column I cited in my Breitbart piece, that liberal writer says that's one of Thomas's great legacies, is he's taught conservative lawyers how to dream again, right? That's, and go big, right? And go back. And what Thomas does, just for, you know, a lot of people call it originalism. It kind of sounds like a funky name. Like, what is that? All it means is, here's what the Constitution said at the time, as it was understood, and that's how we're going to apply it. If you don't like it, the Constitution is an incredible document that has its own amendment process built in, right? And if judges start to substitute their, you know, their view of what that means, or they want to update it because it's outdated, that's dangerous. These are unelected people, right, that don't represent a society, don't represent democracy, right?
They don't stand for election. They don't stand for election. I mean, that is the thing about, like, if you don't like the Second Amendment, there is an actual amendment process to amend it. And many amendments.
Second Amendment, probably, that's how it got there.
Yeah, exactly. But how many amendments are there? How many Emmys?
I think it's 26, I think.
26. I mean, you know, yeah. It's not an unusual process. Like, it's not a difficult, you know, of course it's difficult, but it's been done many times. They banned alcohol and then they didn't unban alcohol. Like, you know, that these things, you know, that's a big thing to do. So if you don't like the American Constitution, you're perfectly entitled not to like the American Constitution, and you can change it.
Yeah, you can amend it.
There is a history there. And I funny. So yeah, I mean, Scalia would be the originalist, wouldn't he? Would you say that?
100%. I mean, yeah. Antonin Scalia, incredible force himself. Came along in the 70s. Was appointed in 86. And yes, as appointed the Supreme Court in 86. And as I think Justice Kagan said, we're all originalists now because of Justice Scalia. Yeah. I think when you look at originalism and how it was being applied, I think most people would say, and most scholars, and particularly on the conservative side, would say that Justice Thomas has been the more faithful and sort of pure originalist. And that even on some important issues, you know, Scalia was coming Thomas's way. Well, you can have a competition.
Scalia came out here to speak to a bunch of conservatives here in Hollywood. So the lawyers out there will appreciate this. And our friend Boris is a composer for a music composer, and he composes music for movies. And after the event, he met Scalia. And Scalia says, hello, Boris. And what do you do? He said to Boris. And Boris says, I compose music for movies. And Scalia goes, that's a very difficult thing to do. How do you go about doing that? Right? Because he was interested in nothing. And Boris says to him, well, what I do is I sit down and try and work out the creator's original intention. And Scalia thought it was the funniest thing he'd ever heard. You know. So, yes.
Well, that is actually... seeing the score developed for the Created Equal movie and the composer was really revelatory to me. So, you know, to capture, you know, you see it all the time in backgrounds of movies, but seeing it on a movie I worked on and then put that score on. But that is a funny thing. That's a digress.
By the way, just you know, when you say that, and again, we couldn't recommend the film more. It's really, really beautiful. It's extraordinary, actually, and very moving. As you say, not a dry eye in the house. We've watched it a number of times now. What can people do? You know, people who are listening to this and who are angry, people who have either seen the movie already or are planning to see the movie, what should they do to register their disgust of what happened during Black History Month?
Leaving comments on their site is a great start. You know, writing to Amazon, you know, hopefully there'll be more stories. I'm waiting for the answer as to why it's, you know, but buy the movie, go other places and watch it and leave a review on Amazon about, you know, so I was really encouraged by, you know, how people responded, you know, to my article, but to all the other articles that came and coverage about it, because it really is outrageous that they, you know, that they took this movie down. And it would have been, like I said, but for, again, maybe somebody else would have discovered it. But for me, it was just on February 8th, I was looking to send it to a friend and it wasn't there. Another person may have just gone on with their life, right? A more normal person. I was involved with that movie, so I was pretty ripped.
Thank God for the abnormal Mark. Abnormal Mark Pilot.
Yes, yes.
So Mark, we want to get on to the two questions that we ask everyone about recipes and art. But I want to ask you, you have a new role now. You've left the White House. Obviously. And tell us about your new role and your new organization and what you want to achieve there.
Center for American Restoration. So my view, as you talked about OMB is the tip of the spear for implementing the president's agenda. And I think that OMB, you know, most people were, you know, wanted to implement the president's agenda who worked in his administration. But, you know, our view was maybe not as hard as they should have tried. But
yeah, no, you know, I wanted to say that was, you know, that you were the person trying to fight the swamp. You know, and that was what the Washington Post didn't like about that, because you're aggressively promoting. Yeah. Look, if you're not aggressively promoting the president's agenda, you're an enemy of democracy. Actually, you shouldn't be there. I mean, and you're perfectly entitled not to want to promote any president's agenda, but just don't serve in that president's administration.
Go work in Costco instead.
Yes,
Yeah, and I think again, I love working in Washington. I love working for this president. I love working for Bush 41 and working on Clarence Thomas. And I think when you go all out, you can make a difference. And that's what I think we did with the Justice Thomas confirmation. Mm-hmm. Some people wanted to quit on that, right? Finding money for the wall. President Trump wanted to find money for the wall. He went to Mick Mulvaney, who was the director of OMB. He was the director of OMB at the time. He became chief staff editor. And that was one of my tasks. What's the legal authority that we can find to transfer funds? This is after Congress didn't give us the money. And what could we legally transfer to help accomplish one of the president's signature, you know, promises, right? Is to build a wall along the southern border. And we did that and we fought hard. It was an incredible group of people. I think the best group of people in the administration was at OMB, where we sit in the executive office of the president, sort of right across the street from the West Wing. And so we're dealing with all the agencies and to make sure the president's agenda is being implemented, using our levers at OMB to help make that happen. And so when we left the White House, we thought we wanted to continue doing that, right, and pushing the Trump agenda. So some of this big tech stuff, I mean, this issue with canceling the Clarence Thomas movie is like right up our alley, right? The critical race theory stuff, right? The cultural Marxism, immigration, you know, America First foreign policy. Those are the kind of things that we want to continue, if you want to call it Trumpism, you know, past the Trump White House. And I think that Russ Vogt, who I think was, you know, kind of brings the intellectual heft. He worked at Heritage Action for many years. He was up on the Hill. He worked for Pence and, you know, very, very savvy and he's and smart. And I thought he did a great job as OMB director, really could understand and channel the president's, what the president wanted to do. So Russ asked me to join him. And I, you know, at this stage of my career, I thought, yeah, let's continue the fight. I had been at a bunch of law firms before that, before the White House. And I thought, let's continue the fight and join this group. So that's what I'm doing now.
Good. Well, where can people find out that what's the website for that place?
At AM Restore Center. If you guys put up on your site, it'd be great. I'm looking forward to working with those guys.
You talked about Mike Pence there, and we need to tell people. So Mark, we met Mark, I don't know, 10 years ago, I don't know, whatever. In DC, we were introduced by a friend and we became friends. And then I actually, when I first did Ferguson, I wanted to go to DC and I wanted to just give people a little taster of what it was about. So I hired a theater in DC to do maybe half an hour off the Ferguson play, which is an hour and a half. And it's a verbatim reading of the grand jury testimony. And one of the characters in it
is a lawyer,
is the prosecutor. And
you thought, do I know a lawyer in DC who could play a lawyer?
Yes. And Mark very kindly played the lawyer and was fantastic, actually. It was a great experience. Actually.
Bob McCullough, right?
Bob McCullough. Yeah.
Bob McCullough, right.
Yes. Yes. And it's a very powerful play and you can see it online as well. We did a reading of it and put it up online. A very powerful play and never more relevant. But then I remember shortly after the Trump election, the 2016 election, we were going to DC and we were supposed to meet Mark for lunch or breakfast or something. And can you believe it? He canceled. And, you know, I mean, come on, you know. And then
on the Alan Field
scoop. On the Alan Field scoop. And then, you know, we phoned him, you know, later on or a week
What's
later.
What's wrong with you?
Hey, Mark, you know.
What happened?
Yeah, you know. And he goes, well, I was asked by the vice president to be his chief legal counsel. I go, okay, you can. And okay, I had to go to the White House. Yeah, I go, okay, you go. You can cancel on that.
We'll accept that.
We'll accept that as a reasonable.
It's pretty good excuse, that, as excuses go.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Well, remember, first, for you, I love you guys and I love what you do. You're warriors, and the Ferguson play was incredible. I felt so lucky to be able to read in it, and then I went up, as you remember, up to off Broadway in New York to go see it on stage, and it was powerful. And all the things you've done, including the Gosnell movie, I remember. I think it was the second day of the Trump administration, and it was right before the Right to Life March, and the vice president was having a reception for pro-life leaders in his ceremonial office. And I invited you to it and you brought your book and you Sure, I have photos of you showing it to the vice president and him signing it.
And we gave him a copy.
Yeah, we gave him a copy, right.
Yeah, and you guys had just literally moved in. You were like in these, and yes, we were like walking, you were like saying, what's this room? We were opening rooms.
I think it was, it was January 22nd. It was like,
it was literally the same.
Yeah, that's right. But we have these two extra questions we ask all our guests at the end of an interview. And the first one is, and I think I know the answer to this, can you cook? And what are you famous for cooking, Mark?
I don't know if it's cooking. I saute a lunch every day, and I'll serve it to my kids. If my wife is traveling, and my kids are all grown now, I would serve them grilled chicken and grilled sausage and kale and walnuts and cranberries and peppers and onions, and put it in a little pan and saute it up on the oven. And I eat that pretty much 80% of the day, 80% of the time. Yeah. And if for dinner or lunch, that's what you're going to get if you're home and my wife's not around. So that's, I don't know if that's cooking, but it's,
I think that sounds like cooking. That sounds very tasty. I like the walnuts as well. I like the idea of the walnuts because kale,
he's
fit in right here, by the way, California.
Yeah.
He's
so, I mean, you know, you can't live in DC without getting a bit of the swamp in you. And I think that kale is
Kale's crunchier. I used to do spinach, but kale's kind of crunchier.
Oh, yeah. That's spinach. Yeah. I can't do it.
You get those stalks that are like a little bit crunchy.
And then the other question we ask people is a piece of art, a poem, a sculpture, a piece of music. And I know you love music. That's really significant and important and inspirational.
Yeah. So I love music and movies. I saw your question. Right now, I'm totally obsessed with sort of the Muscle Shoals sound, right? Which is the music that's kind of the soul music from the 60s. It was a recording studio down in North Alabama. There's a DVD called Muscle Shoals, okay? Which I highly recommend.
How do you spell that?
It's M-U-S-C-L-E. Shoals, S-H-O-A-L-S.
What is it about Muscle Shoals? It's just a little village on the Alabama border. Why does that music come out of there?
Each time a person went to Muscle Shoals, they came out of there with a hit.
Record making like that doesn't happen often. It usually takes somebody like Rick Hall with the drive to do it.
I was going to kick some ass and take some names.
I wanted to be somebody.
Rick Hall had a rhythm section of exceptional players.
Those guys would sit there in that studio and just find a group, you know? And I'd be right there with them singing along. And we'd all work it out together. Rick Hall, he stuck there every minute.
You gotta have a name, and Swampers is a good nickname.
You just didn't expect them to be as funky or as greasy as they were.
R-E-S-P-E-C-T, find out what it means to me.
Paul Simon called Stax Records, talked to Al Bell, and said, hey, man, I want those same black players that played on I'll Take You There. He says, that can happen, but these guys are mighty pale.
Let me take you there. I'll take you there.
We started to explode. The world was coming to Muscle Shoals.
When I think back on all the crap I learned in high school.
You thought you hadn't found a good girl.
Being there does inspire you to do it differently.
It's like when they're coming out, you're stabbed, boom.
It was being funky, you know, that was the whole idea of it.
I began to tell them of this great new deal we'd made with Capitol. One of the guys stopped me and said, we've already made a deal with Jerry, we'll be leaving here. It was war.
You're gonna hear some of the greatest voices that ever were.
There are certain places where there is a field of energy.
You're in rock and roll heaven, man.
And it's a little town down in northwest Alabama. And that is where Aretha Franklin recorded. That's where the Rolling Stones recorded. That's where Bob Dylan recorded. That's where Wilson Pickett recorded. Mm. It's just incredible music that came out of that. There's two studios down there. There was one, and one broke away, and they started a competitor one. And it's this incredible story, but it's this great story about America and the folks in that movie And right after the White House ended, I think 3 days later, I drove to Muscle Shoals, Alabama, nice, to go see the two studios and go down there. And I went to Memphis. So music-wise, it's that almost Muscle Shoals sound, Aretha Franklin, Wilson Pickett, Otis Redding, which is coming over from, right, Stax, which is in Memphis, but recorded down there. Wow. So that's what I've been watching and listening to a lot these days.
Okay, I think we need to check that out.
Yeah,
we need to check that out. But thank you so much for your time today, Mark. And I just think one thing I just want to say before we go is, you know, the Trump administration, we're very, very lucky to have you.
Yes.
I just love this little, I want to share this little tiny thing. Just when things, you know, when the administration was coming to an end and there was the new inauguration and all of that stuff, I remember texting you and saying, you know, where are you? What are you, how are you feeling? How are you doing? And you basically wrote back and said, well, we're going to be here right to the very end. And I loved that because we heard of so many people who kind of opted out early and stuff like that. But I actually had expected you to have gone on Friday or whatever. But no, you stayed until the
noon of inauguration.
Whatever the cutoff was, you stayed till lunchtime and then you handed the keys over, whatever. And I just thought, I loved you for it. I thought, this is, you know, we need more people like you, Mark, who do that kind of public service and take it so seriously and worked and did everything you possibly could to make the agenda of the Trump administration a possibility right up to the last minute. I just loved that. So
thanks, Anne. And I did. I worked up to 11:45 was the last thing I did on inauguration day. And
okay. Well, thank you so much, Mark.
Thanks, Mark.
Thanks for having me. Thanks, guys. Bye.
Well, that was great.
Yes.
I really loved that. And I think Mark's recipe sounds yummy. I like the idea of the walnuts, I have to say. I thought that was great.
Yeah.
And I think he's just a real joy.
It's
and
a very
real
bachelor meal, I thought.
Well, I don't. Why? Because he throws everything into one pan.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you know what? It's in heavy. I'll tell you one thing. You talk about heavy rotation. That meal is in very heavy rotation in the Paoletta house. By the way, we've met his young. And I think now they'd be well able to complain. I would say it's probably quite nice. By the way, he's been at it for years.
So he's,
and I bet
he refines it.
He's probably got some refinements, which we should probably ask about.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't ask him about what kind of oil he used or whatever, but I think we need to probably taste it at some point.
Yes,
Philip.
Yes.
So
now this is my little hobby. So most of our listeners will have never heard of the podcast Call Her Daddy. For very good reasons. And I had never heard of a podcast called Her Daddy. And it is, at the moment, number 22 most popular podcast in the United States.
Probably on planet Earth.
Probably on planet Earth. So basically, it's a sex podcast where two women are talking about sex. And my
husband listens to this.
And I mean graphically talk. Your husband didn't listen to it. So what got me interested in it was that they started off as a podcast and then they were brought into the Barstool Sports arena and promoted.
Which is a platform.
It's a platform and it's a sports platform and it's a podcast.
So it's a really big thing to happen.
And Dave Portnoy, the guy who runs it, is basically a conservative, right? He's the guy who, when he saw all the businesses being closed because of the lockdown, went online and raised, last I counted, it was $18 million.
Hmm.
For small businesses to get them through the lockdown. So they were being paid, I think, so they went from zero to getting paid a lot of money for the podcast took off, went through the roof, stratospheric, and they were in a 3-year contract with Barstool Sports. And they eventually became so successful, they thought we were being underpaid. And it was two girls, Alexandra Cooper and Sophia Franklin. Alexandra did a lot of the work. Alexandra did a lot of the writing. She did all the editing. And Sophia, according to Sophia, wrote a lot of the humor. And Alexandra, importantly, also did a lot of the social media push out. Sophia got herself a boyfriend who was a big executive for a big media company. And so they decided that they could be even bigger and better and richer and wealthy. Like, they're massive. It's massive. It's an international brand now. And they were, the money was just pouring into Barstool Sports. Then during the pandemic, they were being shopped around, even though they weren't supposed to be. And they kept denying it. And Dave Portnoy, and basically they went to Dave Portnoy and they had this meeting, and it's real capitalism actually for these. And of course, these are two young liberal women, right? I mean, and liberal actually, liberal is not the word for it. Libertine is the word for it. I mean, this is sexual promiscuity. This is anything will go. You know, it's tough listening sometimes if you and I wouldn't advise. It's very, very, very R-rated. But now you have these two women who anything goes. We're crazy. We're party kids. We love each other, and they live together too, and they were best friends. So they go and they confront Dave Portnoy and say, "We want more money. We want," and they literally went, "We want $1 million a year, and we want to own all the merchandise and 80% of any alcohol sales that comes out under our brand." And Dave Portnoy goes, "Okay," basically, "Okay." He gives, you know, he maybe says no, and then he says, okay. But then Sophia, her boyfriend has been yapping in her ear. And Sophia says, no, we need to go off and we need to be our own brand and we can be big. And Alexandra, who's the workhorse of the group, says, well, actually, I'm the workhorse. I know how much I worked to start from zero. I don't want to start from zero again. So they had a fallout. And it was very interesting. It was young liberal women finding out about capitalism and reward for merit, and who does the work and who doesn't, and who's the freeloader. And Alexandra said, you're the freeloader, and I don't want anything to do with you. So they split, the Call Her Daddy team split, and Alexandra, as she calls it, she became a single father. And she then continued with the Call Her Daddy brand and has been doing remarkably well. She's number 22 most successful podcast in America. But I think she has become, radicalized. So it's this strange, and now she's getting into her mid to late 20s, and she now, the latest show which I listened to last night because I couldn't sleep, it normally puts me to sleep because it's just mindless yatter. Alexandra Cooper had a woman on called Paige DeSorbo, and she is a reality TV star and a blogger, and she's in a program called Summer House, which is on the Bravo channel, and she's relatively famous. So they're on and they're talking. And of course, this series started off as we can say anything about sex, and they do. And it's ultra R-rated, and I wouldn't recommend that you listen to it. But I've noticed that the series is changing, that the podcast is changing. And this week was like, I was listening to it going, can you hear yourself? So this, her and Paige DeSorbo, first of all, they talked about took questions, and of course the questions from real people out in the real world are very often how can I get married, how can I keep a man? And you know, they're going, oh, you don't need a man. And eventually, you know, there's this disconnect. But so there was a question, what happens, have you ever had a man, you know, ask you to go halfers on a date, and what do you think on that? And they go into this rant about basically, I mean, how awful it is if a man expects them to pay for their date, or even pay half of
their
date.
For dinner.
And then they go, you know, ultimately, man, you got to understand, we only want to be taken care of.
I'm all for like equal rights in women, and I'm down to split things. I'm down to pay for things when like we're in a relationship, like absolutely. And I like being able to buy my own, because I hate feeling like I owe someone something. But like at the end of the day, you're trying to date me. Like that's why we're going on dates. We're hanging out. Like we're seeing if this could be a relationship. And like, come on, dude. It's one dinner.
When you're in the beginning stages, like if you're asking me out on a date,
yeah,
you're paying. And I know maybe that sounds like a little stuck up, but like I don't give a, like if a guy's asking me on a date, shouldn't even have to bring my wallet.
Like, it took me 2 hours to get ready for this. My makeup is $10,000. Like, if I threw all of this away and had to go buy it, I'd spend $5,000. You can pick up this $100 check for some dumb pasta you bought me.
And I know it's superficial, but it doesn't. Girls can be superficial. Anyone is superficial. When you get something nice that you're not expecting, it's like, oh my God.
It's also like
really thinking.
It's like human instincts. Like, of course we want to be equal to the guys, but there is like an innate feeling of like, we want to feel like we're being taken care of a little, and like, we want you to be like manly and macho, and like, it's not about the money. It's just like, you thought of us. You want us to be safe. Like, you want to in some way protect us and like help us out. Like, send the Uber. Like, it's not.
an Uber.
It's $30. Like,
it'll benefit you later down the line.
Trust us.
Trust.
We'll take care of you after.
Paige just said to herself, maybe the 3-date situation may go down to the first date.
Like, send
just
me an Uber.
An Uber.
Basically, Jane Austen.
It's Jane Austen.
Basically, you know, 19th century.
Treat us nice. Send us an Uber.
So for all their R-rated chat and all of their kind of super Uber liberal kind of ways, they're extremely conservative in what they really want. When you boil it all down, they want someone to take care of them. And they actually even use the word that they want men to be kind of man up.
Macho.
And be macho.
Yeah, let's hear a little bit of it. Honestly, we have to be very careful with this because it's very R-rated. So you'll hear a little bit of this. You know, enter this podcast at your own risk, and you probably don't want to enter it. So then they go on to talk about boys and how to get a boy and how to keep a boy and all this. And they come to the startling conclusion that if they are sexually promiscuous on the first night or the second night, that men won't respect them and won't date them long term. And it's like, you sound like your grandmother. Your grandmother told you that. And, you know, everyone on the planet knows this. Like, but it's very funny. Every generation thinks they rediscover the wheel, you know?
They suddenly got this wisdom that no one else had ever thought of before.
And you can hear them going, I mean, you know, that's quite amazing. And let's hear it.
So you're going to hear that.
Yeah.
But a lot of my guy friends, which is such a double standard.
Totally.
They obviously want to sleep with you on the first date. But if you let them, even though they're trying to, if you let them, they're immediately turned off. And it's like, I hate that feeling.
My mom was saying something to me because she was like, it's so annoying me because her friend kept saying things about like her son's friends that would be like, oh, he's such a great guy. He just has to get it out of his system. He's like hooking up with a bunch of girls and then he's going to be an amazing husband. Can you imagine someone ever saying she just has to around with all these guys, get it out of her system, then she's going to be an amazing wife? Why is it a double standard?
No,
yourself.
It's so annoying because all of my guy friends, this brings up such a good point, because all of my guy friends are like, we're not ready for relationships. And I was like, no, I totally, like, I get that. Like,
right.
You don't get in one if you don't think that you can be faithful to someone. But like, they're like, but you're the type of girl we'd want to date. Like, you're independent, like, you're funny, you're successful. And I'm like, I'm right here.
Right.
Like, so like, if you want to date me,
I'm right here.
But like, if I ever said, yeah, I'm just going to go like all these guys, right, and like I'm not ready, they'd be like, you're a whore.
But actually, here's my favorite. So there's my favorite line from them. They're talking about trying to make a go of it in New York, and let's hear the shock that Paige DeSorbo had when she finally got her act together in New York.
What, did you have a job at the time?
No, I had no job. My parents were like...
You're helping with your rent?
My parents were financing everything for me. They were like, we're giving you 6 months. And if you can't figure it out in 6 months, you have to come home. So like month 5, I was like, I need to figure this out. I ended up getting a job. I interned for a little and then I ended up getting a job at ABC News as an assistant. And I was like, okay, great. Now I can, like, pay my own rent. Like, I'll be fine. I got my first paycheck in New York, and I called my mom, and I go, Mom, I think I have to call HR. Like, they took a ton of money out. Like, what's going on? She goes, hi, that's called taxes. And I was like, is anyone talking about this? And she goes, I don't know, only the whole country. Like, get it together.
Yes, Paige. It's called taxes.
It's called tax, yes. And by the way, I don't agree with her mother, by the way, that the whole country is talking about it. No, about half the country are talking about it. The other half, you know, don't seem to understand that it's happening.
Yes. A lot of people are... I mean, the problem is these women now, I mean, because their podcast is so successful, they're probably wealthy enough to pay lots of money in taxes.
And they don't care because they don't notice it because they've got half of a huge amount of money is still a huge amount of money.
But I really appreciated the shock that they had. When, especially living in New York, you pay 50, maybe more, 60% of your...
But I would like to just make a disclaimer here and try and explain my husband's behavior listening to this very R-rated podcast. My husband has a huge interest in podcasts in general, and he's always listening to the ones that are very, very successful to try and work out what, you know, what the secret sauce is, yes, and what exactly are they selling and what are people interested in listening to. So it's interesting for that, from that point of view. So that's sort of his excuse, really.
Well, I was also interested in the capitalism war at the beginning, right? I mean, I had never heard of this one, but then
that's, you know, the reason that you came to that podcast in the first place, because these two women had this massive falling out over suddenly discovering the business world and capitalism, yes, and ownership and working for a living and somebody not pulling their weight in a business.
But also working for a boss and working for a business and realizing the business had responsibilities.
But I kind of hated that story quite a lot, because I just think, and I remember when we got into business, when we started in business, a friend telling us, you know, if you sign a contract, you know, that's it.
Yeah.
You know, suck it up after that. You know, that's what you did.
You grow up.
Read the contract very carefully. Be a grown up when you're signing a contract. Don't cry afterwards.
They tried to break their 3-year contract 2 years in, right? And it's like,
that's not very fair.
You wouldn't be half of what you were if it wasn't for the publicity that Barstool Sports gave you and the promotion. And now you're using that and trying to break your contract.
Okay, we're moving right along. And we're moving on to Governor Cuomo of New York. Governor Cuomo of New York has been getting a lot of attention lately, yes, in the press, but not for the reasons we think he should be getting the attention. He's getting a lot of attention apparently for sexual harassment, right?
Yes.
And by the way, the second woman who has accused him of sexual harassment, I can say as a woman, I was like, seriously? So the woman in question is upset because he asked her, was she monogamous? I mean,
would she date an older man?
The first woman now, who he grabbed apparently and kissed, totally different situation.
Yes.
But just to talk to someone that you're working with and ask them, would you date an older man? I actually think it's fairly legit. But anyway, he's getting enormous attention. Yes. Now the media is like, they're all over this thing.
And they're going to fire him. But the real reason they're going to fire him is because they know what he really did. That he killed all the old people.
Yeah. Because he didn't want to accept
Trump's offer of the ship. He didn't want to accept the Javits Center, the Trump Javits Center. So he sent the old people back to the old people's home, killed about 10,000 old people, and then covered it up, as his aide admitted on a secret tape, and covered it up. He committed criminal killing of these people and then a criminal cover-up. And they know that's going to come out. So they're trying to get him out. And that'll make the Democrats look bad. And you know what? It'll probably make Trump look a little bit better. So they don't want that to get out. So they're happy to throw Governor Andrew Cuomo under the sexual harassment bus, because
it'll take attention away from the fact of what he actually did. And what he actually did was refused the help of President Trump, because he didn't want President Trump to look good. And President Trump actually had really stepped up with the situation in New York, which was a really bad situation, where it was like one of the worst places on the planet Earth in terms of COVID, and where the president had come up with a brilliant idea by sending the Mercy ship, which was sitting in the harbour, where the older people coming out of hospitals still with COVID but recovering could have gone there, could have safely been quarantined there in a very nice situation with great staff. Mm. The whole thing was all well set up, same as the Javits Center. Neither of those facilities were ever really used. And instead, he insisted on denying Trump any kind of glory and sending those people back into an unsafe, and making those safe environments of those old people's homes extremely unsafe for everyone, with the result that thousands and thousands and thousands of people died unnecessarily. And it's a horrible situation.
Yeah.
But he's getting his comeuppance, but he's not getting his comeuppance for what he should be getting his comeuppance for.
Yeah.
And we have a great recipe. We have a really great recipe this week, which is our kind of heavy rotation recipe around here. Mm-hmm. And it's really great. And you'll see me now.
It's our
paletta. Look out. I'm out here on the patio working on this. So this is two nice pieces of salmon here. And sometimes, by the way, people like their salmon a little bit less cooked, more cooked. And actually having two pieces like this is actually useful, because one piece will be cooked more for those people who like it that way. And all you got to do
with this. I have a question about that.
And by the way, what I've chosen here, I'll get you a question in a minute. What I've chosen here, by the way, is wild caught Alaskan salmon, which I'd highly recommend. It's got all the right omegas, by the way. And it's got a lovely natural colour there. Dry it off. It needs to be dried off. Dry it off really, really well. And then pepper and salt. What's your question, Phelan?
So you know when people say that the hottest part of the oven is the top of the oven? Do they say that?
People say all kinds of things about ovens. And ovens are all different. That's the other problem with an
oven. No, but in general, so I find, though, that if you put something at the top of the oven and something at the bottom of the oven, the thing at the bottom of the oven cooks quicker.
If it's very close to the actual bottom,
yes.
Actual, if it's actually nearly touching the bottom, yes, of the oven, the bottom of the oven is very, very hot.
That's
what other people do is they put it on a shelf in above the bottom. But if it's super,
even,
super near,
I think even just above the bottom, I think it's still.
If it's a little bit close to the bottom at, yes, all, it's going to, okay, get very, it's going to, so, get very, you, very
so
hot.
So middle versus top, top is hotter.
Top is hot because, okay, heat rises apparently.
Yes.
But I think everyone's ovens are different, and that's why I'm always a little reluctant to kind of give people very hard and fast numbers. I think with fish, the great thing about fish, it's incredibly easy to cook, but the, it's very, very easy to cook, but the biggest problem is it's very, very, very easy to overcook.
And what else did you have?
And what you want to do is you want to be very careful on the timing. Undercooked rather than overcooked, because if you've had undercooked, all you got to do is pop it back into the oven. And what I decided to do with this, and this is what we do here all the time, is pepper and salt, good shake of pepper and salt, and then some butter, nice Irish butter, salted butter on top as well to give it some moisture. Put that in under the broiler, and I just did this for 7 minutes. The smaller piece there, the thinner piece is cooked really, really well cooked for those who like it that way. And also what I did was when I take it out of the broiler, I just give that a good squeeze of lemon. And we have a very nice lemon tree, so we're very lucky we always, mm-hmm, have lemons. Lovely squeeze of lemon on that. And then it just is really, really moist. And then serve that with a really nice crunchy green salad. And people, I mean, it goes down incredibly well around here, and it's very heavy rotation. It looks great on a plate. Obviously, check with people if they eat fish, but isn't it just delightful, Phil?
Lovely.
It's like the best thing ever. And the great thing is, it's great for company. And sometimes, obviously, in this case, I use two small pieces of fish. Great idea is to go, if you have a membership of Costco, again, I wish I was being paid by Costco for all the ads I do for them, I would get the full fillet, which is great and looks lovely on the plate.
And I guess there's no cultural appropriation in that.
With the Alaskan salmon?
No.
I don't know. We could find out. Oh, and then, because cultural appropriation is very important with food. So Bon Appetit, we have found out. Bon Appetit are going back through their archive of recipes that go, well, you know, back, decades back, to find recipes and ingredients that might be offensive, and to try and either eliminate those recipes, yeah, or clean them up. Because apparently, like, the word exotic is super insulting.
Oh, yeah?
And I haven't even really dug into this too much because I just think it's ridiculous. But by the way, Brett Stevens wrote an article about it. He wrote an op-ed on it the week after his other op-ed had been spiked by the New York Times. And he seems to be still happy enough to work with them. But anyway, yeah, so now it's got to a stage where we're so woke we have to rewrite recipes, but there'll be no rewriting recipes around this house. And we wanted to end this show, by the way, with a little lovely story, which I just loved.
A little lovely story.
Don't even go there, Phelan. Look at this lovely lady. You see the photograph of her coming up there. This is from the New York Times. Lucia de Klerk, the oldest resident of a New Jersey nursing home, beat the coronavirus after she tested positive on her 105th birthday. She was probably going nuts, Phelan, on her 105th birthday. I would say she was out in the town or whatever,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Her tips for living, call
her daddy girls?
Maybe. Her tips for living a long and healthy life, and I love this. Prayer, number one. Avoiding junk food.
Mm.
And then this is classic. Eating 9 gin-soaked raisins each morning. By the way, can I just
What's
say that?
What's a gin soaked
raisin? I have no idea.
Do you soak them? Do you buy them? Or do you do them yourself?
No, I would say you do them yourself. But by the way, I've never heard of it. But then I wrote about this. I put this on my Facebook and somebody wrote in and said that their mother had done gin soaked prunes, which I would definitely prefer prunes to raisins. I think raisins are, I'm a bit anti.
You just want 9 gin soaked prunes because they're bigger?
Or I would just take
carry more alcohol?
Or do you know what? I just take the gin without bothering soaking anything.
Throw the prune in afterwards.
But that is the kind of happy story for the day. And I just love that lady. What a great lady. That was her thing. Prayer, avoid junk food and eat 9 gin soaked raisins each morning.
Yeah.
Or just do the gin. But each morning, though, yeah, I would say that you might want to wait until maybe your 95th birthday to start that regime, maybe. Because early on in life, it might be great to be doing the gin in the morning.
Yeah.
Not great. That's enough from us.
Well, thank you.
Thank you very much for tuning in.
We have a great show next week, actually. We've got a really good interview with a guy. It's going to be very, very interesting.
A little bit disturbing, but yeah, a great interview. So we'll talk to you next week, and thank you so much for tuning in. And don't forget, leave comments, please, on the podcast app, on the YouTube channel. We read everything. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.